Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Hanley, president of the National Concrete Burial Vault Association. I would like to thank everyone for participating on this conference call. We have over 70 people registered today. I'd like to welcome all of you from the funeral and cemetery profession, NCBVA members, and hopefully some future NCBVA members, and suppliers to our industry that have joined us today. The NCBVA board and Peacock Marketing have been working effortlessly to bring value to our members. With that, I would like to introduce the gentleman that has been providing us very informative articles to help our members, and here today to talk about graveside liability. Here's our NCBVA legal counsel, Paul LeMasters. Paul, it's all yours.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining. Again, my name's Paul LeMasters. If you've know or met me before, I apologize for that. And if you haven't heard me before, well, stay tuned. I'll jump right into it. I know that our time is short. What I wanted to do is just kind of recap the article. I will start off with a little bit of a little preface on this. If you're waiting for the end of the call where I have the magic answer that you don't ever have to worry about graveside liability, you may want to hang up now because I don't have that answer. Unfortunately, the reason it's a topic and it's of interest is because it is an issue that there isn't a simple solution. There's a lot of problems and there's a lot of things we can do, but to get rid of it completely is an impossibility. So saying that, we kind of broke the article down into three kind of categories. One more on the equipment side. I know we focused on the tent that blows away. What I would also probably put in here today, just to expand on that, is it's not just the tent, obviously. This is any equipment that you are in charge of or have to use. One of the things that I have found dealing with cases where we deal with any sort of graveside issue, whether it's the casket that falls in, or again, the tent, or any equipment we use, one of the first questions that's going to come from the other side, the plaintiff side on this, is when was the last time your equipment was inspected? And then they're going to say, well, okay, when was that? Well, most of the time, I can tell you the answer is we don't. Or it seemed to be working fine. Then if you do say yes, they're going to say, what's your inspection process? And then again, the typical answer I end up seeing or hearing is, well, we just make sure it's working. So I can tell you right away that one of the biggest things you can do to protect yourself is to have a good inspection process. And make sure, and especially if you're using other equipment, you know, one of the other problems I see is that we convolute the issue, because what will happen is the cemetery, depending on who we are and what we do, sometimes we'll use other people's equipment in our process. Nothing wrong with that, but it just heightens the responsibility of knowing what to do or, you know, when to use it and to make sure that it meets all your standards and your requirements. The other thing in the article that I touched on is this walk-away policy. It comes down to this is, I don't want to say we live in a more sensitive society, but unfortunately, I think we live in a more sensitive society. So a lot of the issues that we may have taken for granted before aren't, we aim to please, so to speak, meaning what we always do is we say yes, and then we figure out how. And companies are, I think, to a fault overdo this, meaning somebody says, look, I got a family. They want to have a graveside. I know the grave's full of water. I know it's going to be tough, but I need you to get it done. And then somehow, some way, we make it work. That's not always the best answer. And more, I think it's important that we as companies have these walk-away policies so that we are able to say, look, if the weather's extreme, which we seem to be seeing more and more of, we walk away. There's another side to this too, and I'll share it with you. And it hasn't made a lot of headlines yet, but again, because we're changing, I also see this as an employer. This is an OSHA issue as well. OSHA has made it very clear that they have, while they don't have a specific policy on extreme weather for employees, it is something that they comment on and that they do concern themselves with, meaning if you put your employees in an unsafe weather environment, you can be responsible. One of your jobs as an employer is to provide a safe working environment, weather included. So we're starting to see this again with these extreme weather changes. That means cold, means excess rain, flooding. All these are extreme circumstances. And if, as an employer, vault company, you put your people in these positions and then there is an injury, understand that you could have a heightened area of liability when it comes to that safety. The next issue we talked about was falling in. I tried to cover the basics on this idea of falling in. You know, one of the biggest problems we have when it comes to the gravesite is knowing who's in charge. And my typical discovery is finding that everybody thinks everybody else is responsible. We tend to automatically think the cemetery is responsible because it's their property. We tend to think that the funeral home is responsible for the casket because they're constructing the pallbearers and they're the ones that are there. And a lot of times they're the last ones to leave. And then the vault company, a lot of times you're in the midst under the control of these individuals you've either been hired for or and it becomes what is your responsibility. And the idea is to understand that everybody shares that responsibility. You know, the idea that, well, I didn't tell them to do it, so it's not going to be my fault. When it comes down to it, everybody can ultimately be held responsible. The one thing, again, article is limited on what we could do. I would add in here is there are some new cases under OSHA again that are getting into these extended or expanded areas of what's called host employer versus contract employer. And this is a lot of times where vault companies fall in. So the host employer would be typically maybe a cemetery that's hiring or the funeral home that's hiring the vault company to do work who becomes a contract employer. And the reason it becomes these cases are becoming important is what they're doing is they're actually now starting to say that everybody shares in this potential liability. The recent case, I'll just share it with you real quick, it was Qualcomm. It was electrical work being done. And the contractor came in to do the work. The owner of the property was supposed to make sure everything was shut down. It wasn't. So when the worker approached, he was electrocuted, suffered third-degree burns. And what they found is a lot of times the typical thought is, well, hey, that's an independent contractor. They were responsible. They got hurt. It was all their fault. And in this case, they found three people responsible proportionately. One was the host company. So where the facility was, the property owner, they didn't do a good enough job making sure it was everything was turned off properly. They didn't instruct properly. So they bared some of the liability. The contractor bared some of the responsibility because they didn't take special precautions. And then they also found the employer themselves partially liable because they weren't wearing all of their PPE. And again, that also went back to the contractor because they didn't provide them with the PPE. So again, a lot of areas here for the liability when we get there. The other thing that is becoming, I'm seeing more cemeteries, and I'm going to say cemeteries, but this is vault companies, anybody that's digging graves. There's been a little bit of a rash of trenching cases. I know we've seen these kind of, I think many of you have seen these anyway, where these grave collapses have happened. OSHA's coming in. And right now what OSHA says is that a grave being dug is a trench and you have to follow certain protocols, including potentially shoring up. I think a lot of people, and I have not seen a firm written opinion on this, but I one of the things I hear from a lot of the people that have had the issue happen is they say, well, I'm only 3 foot under the below ground, so I avoid that. They don't count the top of the vault. They count the whole entire grave, meaning you're probably closer to 5 or 6, which puts you into the trenching requirements. Again, just something to be aware of to make sure that you're meeting all the requirements. And again, depending on where you put your employer, even if you don't dig the grave, you could have potential liability too, because you are then working on it. It's that host employer, contract employer issue. Then the last issue we wrote about was the opening the casket. Again, I see this, it goes through, you know, spurts and really you can wrap it all under this idea of disinterment, especially speaking to vault companies. What I typically see happen is that the funeral home, cemetery, they agree or decide that it's okay to disinter. They then call the vault company to say, do it. And then we do it, and we don't realize if everything's been done properly or not. The problem is I see a lot of funeral homes and cemeteries do disinterments contrary to what regulations say should be done. That means if you, the vault company, are helping, you put yourself at the same liability, same risk. And so, you know, the simplest thing, and someone can correct me, and if it's not on the member site, we can make sure it is, because we addressed this a couple years ago, I think. But, you know, the simplest thing is getting a release signed if we're doing a full disinterment. And the problem is that the release should include everybody, not only the funeral home, the cemetery, but also the vault company. You potentially are taking some of the most risk. And a lot of times I find we don't address simple things like, what happens if the vault breaks when we're pulling it out? Who's responsible? Who's going to replace it? And who's going to get rid of the old vault? Some of these little things. Now, granted, what does happen, that people wing it. So they just, whatever happens, they figure it out as they go along. I don't know that that's the best way. And we are seeing more and more disinterments. There's been an increase, a lot of people disinterring to either regain cemetery space or for cremation later. A lot of reasons for it. But again, making sure we do this properly is critical. And that's where that comes. You know, one of the, I'll before I open up for questions, which I'm going to do here in about 2 minutes, you know, one of the questions that probably I think came out of all this is what do I do to protect myself? I'll throw a couple basic things out there, and so we have at least something to build on and maybe questions from that. One is, as far as your insurance goes, I find a lot of people don't know or realize what their insurance covers and doesn't cover. So one of the simplest things is to make sure your insurance, what does cover, and possibly listing some of these cemeteries or that you're being hired by or where you're doing work as additional insureds, to make sure you're covered for everything that need be. The other thing that I find, and I know nobody likes contracts, everybody thinks they're bad, but possibly if you have contracts with the people that you're providing these services for, do you have that type of an arrangement? And if you do, what's in that? You know, do you have anything that limits your liability? Do you have those provisions, these, again, walkout provisions? Or, you know, if you can't make it because of weather or accident, how do you cover those? So just some basic things that are out there. And I think I was supposed to stop at 15 minutes. I think I did pretty well, which is shocking already. And at this point, what I would ask is, if you wanted to ask a question, hit *2, and I believe that unmutes your line, and then you'll be able to ask a question. Again, please say your name and where you're calling, your business, and then the question you have. Please don't be shy.
Paula, this is Dale Cameron, the Piedmont Precast in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
One of the comments you made is about inspecting equipment. What do you recommend? That be done on a monthly basis, quarterly basis? What do you recommend on inspecting equipment?
So it's a great question. So how often do you inspect? I think it's going to depend on what the equipment is. And you know, here's the thing. You can probably set that standard yourself. You know, some things, maybe it's quarterly. You know, your lowering device may be obviously a little bit more than the tent. But as long as you, here's the thing, having some process is huge when you probably don't have any process. And as long as you can show, here's the thing, and again, somebody tell me, you know, what's the average life expectancy of straps on a lowering device? If it's about 6 months, then you probably want to inspect it maybe every quarter so that we're ahead of the game. And that's how I would do it. And again, the big part of that inspection process is a few things. One, make sure you have a process and you document it. And then make sure your people understand it and that, you know, they're actually fulfilling it. And they, again, you have a good way to record it so it's done. Ultimately, it does protect you because you can say, hey, we inspected, we just did, and here's what we look for. Because then if something does go wrong, it's a lot easier as defense, not that this is foolproof, but to say, look, we regularly inspect. This was a fluke accident. We don't know what happened. You can't make that argument if you start off by saying we've never inspected this equipment before. We know it worked fine yesterday, but that's it.
Thank you, Paul. Anybody have any recommendations on a written walkaway policy?
Can you repeat that again?
Does anybody have any recommendations on a written walk-off policy?
It's a great question. If anybody, let me add something to that. One of the reasons I brought that up and talked about it is somebody had shared with me that their insurance company told them, and I've had a couple people kind of confirm this, that if the wind or weather met these certain conditions, that they wouldn't cover certain damages. So again, a great question to understand and know, because that may be different. But again, you know, you may have a policy that, you know what, if a grave's full of water, we're not going to do anything. We're going to wait till that's dry. Because I've seen where vault companies have been forced to set a vault in a flooded grave. And that may not be want to be one of your practices.
Paul, Jeff Hardy, can you hear me?
Yep.
I was the one who actually brought up that walk away on the tent, and we set the policy at 35 miles an hour if winds are predicted in excess. Unfortunately, a few times the weather man wasn't right, and we did get a little bit of grief from the funeral homes, but we said, look, we've got to err on the side of caution, especially in this litigious world we live in. And to go back on the first question, and I don't know if Blake Swinford's here or not, the board is looking at expanding the certification process to include a checklist of 10 devices and things like that. And hopefully we can distribute that to our membership and give them like maybe a guidance that they can use. So if something does come up, you can say, yep, here's the date, here's our checklist, and we went through it.
Hey, Jeff, can I throw in one thing on that? This is Blake. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep, please yep. Do.
Does anybody out there on the phone call use a device that brings back my Little League days where they have an app on a phone that talks about lightning strikes within a two-mile radius of that phone? So if your guy is sitting out at the graveside and there's lightning around, there's an app that can say, hey, you're within 2 miles. You should probably not you have to evacuate all for a half hour. Does anybody on the call use anything like that at this point? Or should we include that in that route, that walk-off thing? And I'll listen to what everybody has to say.
It's Jeff again. I know our phones have weather alerts because I can tell you a few times sitting in a restaurant and all of a sudden hearing everybody's phone go off knowing there was a major storm on its way. So I don't know if it's a regional thing or the weather service ties into Google or whatever it is, but to your point, I know we have something similar to that.
I got a question, Paul. This is Steve Handley.
Yeah. Good, Steve.
On transporting disinterments, the liability.
Yep. So, by the way, after you guys ask your question, you may want to unmute or remute your line with your star two, because we're getting feedback from, I think, too many lines. But so liability, once you make the disinterment, yeah, there's a risk. And probably that, because that's not, I'll say, the norm. A typical disinterment, at least as I come across them, we're staying in the same cemetery. If we're removing and going to another cemetery, you want to make sure that that's covered and how that's covered. I believe in the release we put together for NCBVA that there is that part of that is covered. But absolutely, you know, that's a heightened area of liability, all the way down to who's going to watch and how you control that. One of the questions that I was asked prior to the call was, you know, how do we handle the gravesite, you know, as far as people, you know, during a regular, you know, do we even block it off so people can't get that close or whatever? I mean, what I wanted to be able to say is I don't think you have to go to that extreme. Normally, if the grave is falling in, then it is up to probably you to be able to say it's that, you know, hey, I saw it, I'm responsible, I'm going to do it. I wrote about, one of the cases I wrote about was the stage collapse at the Indiana State Fair. One of the problems there is that a lot of people had thought that they knew something was going to happen between the weather, the way the equipment was set up, and nobody spoke. That's why the liability is so high. So you may have to do that. But what it really comes down to is just knowing who's in control, that somebody knows. So again, and I'm going back to my days as funeral director, many times I'd get to the cemetery, there was nobody really there. And I just went and did it. And where what would have been helpful is to have that good communication, which I know I'm living in a fantasy world. I know we don't all talk to each other all the time, but we just have to start. But where, you know, the vault company communicates with the cemetery, maybe to the funeral home, however the circle works, making sure that everybody knows, hey, here's what's going to happen, here's what's going on. That's how you start.
Hey, Paul, this is Allison Raymer, and I have a question regarding disinterment as well. We are a brand new vault company, and so we have not done a disinterment yet, but I'm wondering what kind of documentation do we need to have on file for a disinterment? Are there documents that the funeral home gets from the state giving them permission to perform this? Do we need to have a copy of that on file? What do you suggest for a disinterment documentation?
Great question. So every state's different, so that would be part of it. A lot of states, if it's a disinterment staying in the same cemetery, there's little to no paperwork required. But that's more of a reason why what I want is a release, the release that identifies all of the parties and that you've been given permission. And the main thing we're going to have on there is the property owner and the legal next of kin signing off saying it's okay. And I'll say that's the minimum. And then your question may be to the funeral home or cemetery, were there any other paperwork that was gathered either from the court or from the vital statistics? And if they say yes, I don't have a problem with you asking for a copy of it. And then you have a disinterment file where maybe you keep all the disinterments you've ever done.
Paul, real quick, I just wanted to announce to people, too, if they have talked and unmuted our line, if they could hit star 2 again to mute it, because we are getting some feedback again.
You know, what one thing, and I'm not saying we're done. I mean, we're at 2:30, but I'll stay on as long as we have questions. Well, maybe not as long as we have questions, but I'll stay on for a while. The one thing that I would encourage, and here's, I've got to tell you, I love where NCBVA is headed right now, because we're trying to attack some issues that I think are very prevalent that we've kind of just maybe talked about but not done anything. So just on this call today, we addressed something like a walk-off policy. Doesn't sound like anybody has one, maybe. Maybe that, again, is something as a group can work towards to have a, I'll call it a model one. The inspection checklist, maybe what as a group we come up with a model inspection checklist The nice thing about this is if you create these things and then use them, if somebody ever questions, well, why do you think that's good? You can say, well, this is actually from NCBVA that represents the vault companies, and we all agreed that this was the right thing to do. That is a very solid standing on how you do things. My two cents.
Hey, Paul, this is Bruce at Whitman Vault. I got a question for you.
Yes.
Is there any type of back to more so, I guess, for the tents? Is there any type of, I mean, I know you can have the weather and the walk away and that stuff, but we all know how some funeral directors can be regarding that. Is there any type of, like almost like a hold harmless agreement you could have in place that if they insist that you do it, is there any other, you know, is there any, you know, I know there's probably no way to get out of it completely, but if something does happen, you're holding them accountable for forcing you to do it?
I mean, you're right. There's nothing. Here's what I would say. If you have a written policy that you will not do it in, let's use Jeff's 35-mile-an-hour winds, and you know it's going to be that windy, and they're adamant, you set it up, I wouldn't make that a regular thing, but I'd say, we're going to have a release, you're going to take responsibility then. And then that release would say, despite us having a policy, we are agreeing to set this up, you agree to take responsibility. In that case, I think that could give you some teeth. But if you don't have a walk-off policy and you just say, we don't feel like doing it today because it's kind of windy, then it's tougher because you're not basing it on anything.
Okay.
Hey, Paul, what Craig do you Neal think that would be? Wall Company.
I think I heard Norwalk Vault Company.
Hey, Paul, it's Craig from Norwalk. Question for you. We have some cemeteries that are resistant to grave shoring, and these are cemeteries that go 2 and 3 deep. Outside of dropping a dime to OSHA, which wouldn't be good for our relationships with them, do you have any suggestions as to how we can encourage them to use the shoring, that they're in violation of OSHA code?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I can't imagine that you cemeteries really fighting you on this. I mean, like, you guys love each other. I can't even – that one's hard for me to get – I'm kidding. Print off the case where the cemetery, they just got hit for $120,000 because they didn't shore up. Maybe this is something NCBVA puts together and says, you know, why shoring is something we have to, you know, to do. And then you come up with standards as a group. And then here's how it happens. Again, go back to that host employer contract, employer liability. You now have a shared risk. My concern then is, you know it's a problem. They know it's a problem. They say, screw it, we're not going to do anything. You put your employer in the hole. It collapses. You want to sit there and go, we told you, I told you this was going to happen. Well, the problem is, you knew it was going to happen, and you put your employer, you're going to get hit as much as they are. That's the bad side of it. So I think the best thing you can do right now is educate. Try to get them to understand why this is so important.
Excuse my ignorance, but what are we referencing when we say shoring?
So the idea would be is, when you dig the grave, I'm going to say historically, and believe me, I'm not a grave digger. It's not on my list of things that I've got to do in my life. If one of the guys from the vault company want to take me out on a day and teach me, I'll be glad to come along. Probably be a fun day. But the idea is, as say, historically, you dug a grave, you didn't do anything. OSHA actually has trenching requirements that once you dig so deep, you have to shore up or put some supports, either hydraulic plates, wood. You can also bevel the ground. Am I saying this right? Somebody can jump in. But those are the ideas. A lot of cemeteries do not do this. But there are some cases now, some recent ones, where the grave is collapsed, and then OSHA says, you didn't shore it up, that's what caused it, and then you get big fines, and OSHA fines have gone up. So you could easily be in six figures if that happens.
Paul, it's Brian Jeff Hardy again. Obviously, we're not going to be able to go too much longer, but if obviously people have a lot of questions. You can email us. We'll get them to Paul. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do in the newsletter is address certain things. And we've kind of left it open that we can take issues and try to work on them a little bit deeper. So I suggest anybody please forward any questions to the association. And just a quick infomercial, anybody who's going to be at ICCFA, Mark Bates and I are trying to put together maybe a little gathering place at some point during the few days that we can all get together and meet one another and put faces to names. So if anybody's going to be out at the show in Charlotte, please touch base with us.
Hey, Brian DeMoss, Chesapeake Vault, the young lady with the grays. I dig between 2,500 and 3,000 grays a year. If you put her in touch with me, I can have a chat with her about the graves, maybe help her out a little bit. But I'm actually on my way back from a 400-mile disinterment right now. So
I love it. That's what we need.
So I'll be more than happy to help with any of that. And the gentleman with the equipment, we actually just developed a procedure, an equipment procedure checklist and whatnot for our employees. So we can cover all those bases on our equipment to make sure we got the proper equipment on our truck. So I'll help anybody needs help.
Fantastic.
Paul, this is Greg Tilley with Ideal Burial Vault. I don't know who all saw this, but Dan Wagner, I believe, had sent out an email about a unified letter for all of us, you know, having a unified statement of what is safe and what isn't, I guess. And I'm speaking directly of the shoring the graves. And we come across that in both the markets we serve, one more so than the other. One is a city-run cemetery of pure sand, and they're doing double-depth graves. And what we do is we drop the vault. We tell them we're not going to assume liability. You're going to place the vault, you're going to service it, and we will be there if need be. I guess my question to you is, we probably are still liable, and I can tell you this, they had an employee fall in a grave last year, broke his collarbone because he fell, I don't know, it was probably 6 to 7 feet into a concrete vault. Are we still in major liability, even though we're not servicing it?
I mean, I'll say you're probably less, you know. The idea, though, it's still the way OSHA looks at this. You know, they're looking at who's put who at a risk. I'll say that probably falls more to them, though. And it depends if you're there when it's going on or not there. And I agree. I think as a group, this, and maybe, you know, this always happens when we have these talks, but maybe this is the next seminar or webinar article we do is about OSHA and shoring graves and legal implications. Because I think it's an area that's evolving quickly.
Yep, for sure. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate that.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's all about money, and I understand cemeteries are struggling. They're all fighting for space, and it looks really good on paper. But I think you have to take the proper steps. And a lot of these locations, you know, funeral directors are selling a sealed vault, and we set and seal below ground in our area. And it's pretty hard to sell, you know, warranty a sealed product 7 feet below the ground. It's just not going to happen. So,
well, and
I
also,
absolutely.
And I see more and more cemeteries going to double, triple depth. And, you know, that raises a whole new level of concern that some people didn't have before. So, yeah, maybe this is our next topic.
Dan Wagner here. Can you hear me? Did I push the right buttons?
You did perfect, Dan.
Okay. It was exciting to hear, Paul, when you mentioned that the association is kind of embarking on a education and information network going forward. And I would just encourage the association, if I could, to maybe come up with sample documents, i.e. the inspection forms. And that would be something, for example, to work on. And then I had another thought, given the question of what should be the inspection frequency. Here again, maybe my light bulb isn't turned on the way it should. But given the fact that the National Concrete Burial Vault Association is just that, a national association, and we kind of speak for the burial vault industry, would it be proper for us to determine what that inspection frequency should be?
I think
could
it
we,
is.
Could we set the standard?
I think you could, and I think that's what you should do. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, you know, go down this road, you know, if a company decides, screw it, we're not going to do that, the only issue always becomes now that, and I'm not going to tell you that this, it's not that it makes it worse. I know you should inspect, but if there's a recommendation now out there and you still don't inspect, now you've kind of, you're putting yourself at even more, not more risk, but more potential liability. Now, to me, that's a non-issue because you should be doing it. So all we're doing is putting together the guidelines to help you do it and do it more easily.
I guess it was referring to in those guidelines something to the effect that, well, it is recommended that the lowering device mechanical operation be inspected at least annually. And it is recommended that the tent frame be inspected at least annually, that the lowering device straps be inspected at least quarterly, and then design and maybe implement for membership an inspection form, and in my mind's eye I'm seeing, well, what perfect time to inspect lowering device straps and tent poles and so on and so forth. But every time you set it up, much like the DOTs require a daily truck inspection before you pull it out on the road. Well, your setup person then is doing an inspection every time they set it up.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great idea, and like I said, I'm very excited about all these projects and going forward with NCBVA. So I
concur. That's an excellent direction to be going. Congratulations.
Thanks. Well, we are at two.
Brian,
yeah. Do one more.
Brian DeMoss, one more. I won't say anything else. Hey,
nope, you're fine.
Wagner, my son has just developed this procedure sheet. It actually has our daily inspection on it for our trucks. So they're not only inspecting the trucks daily, they're going over and make sure they have the proper equipment daily. And then they sign off at the bottom, just like they're turning in a DOT sheet. Only backside of the sheet's got our inspection for our equipment on it, our bulk carts, make sure everything's on the truck, so forth and so on. Right down to their clothes and make sure they got their nameplate. We're doing it all on one sheet.
So then, Brian, I think that you have gone through all that effort. You should be more than willing to submit that to NCBVA as a sample form for distribution to our membership.
Yeah, we just finished it up. We're actually tweaking it now. But I will. I don't have a problem with it as long as you'll become a board director for NBCVA, because it sounds like we need you on that board.
I like the bartering.
I shouldn't have opened my mouth.
But anyway, and the whole disinterment thing, I'm coming back from one right now where I dug up yesterday and had to take it 400 miles. And, you know, we put on our quote that we're not liable for any vaults. And we bring a vault, extra vault will be at the cemetery in case that one is broken or not any good or whatever, it's failed. And that's the way at extra cost. So I always get on to do that sort of thing. Because I do
that's
a lot
great.
Of disinterments also. So I'm trying to keep out of jail. and my boat holds a lot of gas. So I need to make sure I can get
them. I just think the more we can do for membership in generating these forms and documents, not necessarily that they have to use them, but I think a lot of our membership struggles with maybe a feeling of inadequacy that they're not going to do the verbiage correct, and it would be nice to see someone like Paul review these documents before we send them out, so that they've been reviewed by a professional. And if you choose to use them, fine. If not, fine.
I agree.
Yeah.
One thing that Paul did for me, this is Steve Hanley, is for transporting disinterment, and I gave it to the funeral home to have the family sign, and the family was impressed that that was even thought of, and they had no problem signing it. So I think these forms are a good thing, and I think it shows the family. They told the funeral home, it looks like you're very thorough with everything you do.
How do we get a copy of that form?
Well, I think... You know, I think what we do is we need to start a portal. I mean, this is I think we just need to figure out a way to make them accessible and make sure that they cover everything we need. Steve?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, Steve, I was going to let you – do you want to wrap this up or – I know there's a...
You're doing a good. No, we can wrap it up. I want to. Well, sure. What? Are you done?
Well, yeah. I was going to remind people though, if there's other questions, and do me a favor, if there's topics that you want addressed, and if it's maybe it's not a topic that we could do a whole article, but you know, if I get four or five even quick answer things, maybe we can make that into a separate kind of just a hodgepodge. So I encourage everybody to really reach out and start connecting with the NCBVA using their email, info@NCBVA, right? Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, any other questions, comments, topics, whatever, I can do a lot better if I know what you want to talk about.
And that's one thing Paul's always said. He goes, tell me what you guys want to know. And he'll, you know, help us with articles and stuff on that. So anybody that has any questions for Paul later or has ideas, please forward them to the NCBVA. Lisa and her team will get those questions to Paul, and we can get you answers. We're here for you guys to help you with your businesses to answer questions. And so I'm hoping you're seeing the value for what NCBVA is doing now. Other than that, I want to thank everybody for coming on. We really appreciate it. I think this was a great way to get through it. I believe it's being recorded. I'm hoping we'll be able to get that up on the website if you want to go back and hear it. I'm not sure what they're going to do with that. So, but hopefully we can have that so you can go back and listen. Is there any other questions? Again, Paul, I want to thank you for your time.
Always. Glad to be able to help, glad to offer it, and look forward to the next one we do.
All right. Thank you. I think we'll end this. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys. Thanks.